Please turn to Exodus chapter 22 today. Exodus chapter 22. This week in our study of the book of Exodus, we're studying particularly an area which is the book of the law of the covenant. And that's appropriate because we just asked God in our Psalm, Psalm 119, to teach us His statutes way. And these are indeed His statutes. This is His law. This is very clearly an articulation of that. These laws spell out how God's people are to apply the commandments of God that were just received in the previous couple chapters, chapter 20 particularly. What God was revealing to them was not only His character, as He reveals the laws to them, but their character was important, that the people of God must mimic or imitate Him. It matters as they carry out the mission that He has given them to be a blessing to all the nations. This is part of the means by which that message will go forth. Their testimony of their lives, that they are consistent with what He's saying. Now, these laws applied specifically, in a sense, to the nation of Israel. And therefore, they don't necessarily have a one-to-one correspondence with, say, the laws that we have here in the United States. But they certainly do demonstrate principles that can and indeed should be applied when seeking social justice. So in today's passage, we're going to see two main categories of case studies that He gives. This is kind of, again, kind of wading through some deep water, but we're asking God to show us Himself, His character, and then teach us how we're to live. These two main categories are those laws that are pertaining to private property and then more generally to social responsibility. So let's read what God says in Exodus chapter 22. I'll read the whole chapter, beginning at verse 1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall repay 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. If a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. He shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it's an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. If a man causes a field or a vineyard to be grazed over, or lets his beast loose and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best in his own field and in his own vineyard. If fire breaks out and catches in thorns so that the stacked grain or the standing grain or the field is consumed, he who started the fire shall make full restitution. If a man gives to his neighbor money or goods to keep safe, and it's stolen from the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief is not found, the owner of the house shall come near to God to show whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it is for an ox or a donkey, for a sheep, for a cloak, or for any kind of lost thing, of which one says, this is it, the case of both parties shall come before God. The one whom God condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. If a man gives to his neighbor a donkey or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep safe, and it dies, or is injured, or is driven away without anyone seeing it, an oath by the Lord shall be between them both to see whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's property. The owner shall accept the oath, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is torn by beasts, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn. If a man borrows anything of his neighbor, and it is injured or dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. If the owner was with it, he shall not make restitution. If it was hired, it came for its hiring fee. If a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall give the bride price for her and make her his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the bride price for virgins. You shall not permit a sorceress to live. Whoever lives or whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you do mistreat them, and they cry out to me, I surely I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a moneylender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him. If ever you take your neighbor's cloak in pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down, for that is his only covering, and it is his cloak for his body, and what else shall he sleep? If he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. You shall not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest and from the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. 7 days it shall be with its mother. On the 8th day you shall give it to me. You shall be consecrated to me. Therefore, you shall not eat any flesh that is torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. Now, that's a lot of material, a lot of different subjects in one sense, but they really can be categorized and can be brought down, I think, into a manageable way, and we'll seek to do that this morning. Back in chapter 18, when Jethro came to visit Moses, you'll remember that Jethro saw what was going on in the land of Israel and gave some counsel to Moses. Saw that Moses was going to be overwhelmed and burnt out, and he counseled him to listen to this counsel about the judgment of issues in society, how justice was to be brought when people were at court. And after Moses listened to Jethro's advice, we hear that he found able men from all the people, men who feared God, who were trustworthy and hated a bribe, and placed such men over the people as chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens, and let them judge the people at all times. So this is sort of a system that is now set up of having court, systems of law, and the judgment of issues in among the people. But of course the question is, how did they judge? On what basis did they judge? What were the standards? Well, then Exodus chapter 20 and following, 20 through all 23 really, follows that passage of setting up that court system, if you will. And here God gives these judges case studies to help them understand how they can make decisions that will bring about justice in their society. When there are breaches, and of course there would be breaches of the law, there would be ways to follow through with that. And I mentioned two main categories of law here that are being discussed, and the first one, again, is this issue of private property. A lot of the first section of this chapter in chapter 22 covers this issue of private property. And we're now addressing, in some ways, the implications of the 8th commandment, thou shalt not steal. What is to be done in issues where things are happening that regard to one's property? But if someone does steal, these are some of the guidelines that will seek to bring about a just judgment. What is the right thing to do under these circumstances? Now remember that Israel was a relatively poor nation compared to many, and their person, a person's standing in society was largely based on what they owned in terms of property, and that property largely was with regard to animals, or maybe their fields, or their land. Now, they haven't got particular land yet because they're in a sojourn. They're still journeying through the wilderness. So we're largely thinking about what they have in terms of animals. This is an agrarian society and culture, and so a person's livelihood is tied up in their animals and his fields. Now, the first case that arises here, then, is a theft, and so they use the example of animals. If someone has stolen an ox or a donkey or something of that nature. And the first principle, I think, that we really see in regard to the laws of property is this issue of restitution, the need to make restitution. It's essential that when a criminal steals something, that he, when caught, must be making restitution for the one from whom he stole. And there's not merely a return of the item itself, not just a returning of the thing that was stolen, but indeed there's also a penalty added to the punishment as well. You steal one ox, for example, and you have to pay back 5 oxen. You steal a sheep, and you have to pay back 3 more, 4 total. In law, these are safeguards that are being made, penalties and punishments that are for the purpose of dissuading people from doing a future sin like that. So when God gives these punishments and these laws that give restrictions about certain performances which are crimes, then in fact this purpose of this is to keep people from doing it again, to dissuade people. And on principle, laws and their penalties that we make today should accomplish the same thing. They should be trying to dissuade future breaking of the law. This principle is one that can be applied, I think, in lots of different areas, not simply in the area of law and court systems and so on. Certainly it's applicable there, but penalties that are substantial yet reasonable are motivations in society for people to walk obediently. And that's true across the board in lots of different areas. For example, in the classroom, when teachers are guiding children or young adults in this area of training. Parents, of course, and their parenting, of disciplining of their child, how we give restrictions or punishments that are added. Parents who have no consequences, and we sometimes see this in society around us, for wrongdoing in their homes, and, or who don't communicate to the child before they've done the crime what the punishment will be. If parents are failing to do that, they're really failing to help their children learn to obey in the future. So that's something we can apply immediately. The higher the value of the item that was stolen in these cases, of course, you have the greater the penalty for stealing it. And in the same way, the greater the infraction in the classroom or the greater the disobedience in the home, it should result in the greater the consequence. But particularly, we might want to be careful to note here an idea of justice that needs to be in our bringing about of penalty. Oftentimes in our society, when penalties are measured out, they are paid to the wrong person. They're paid to a third party who's enforcing the rule. You know, you break the law and so on, and you have to pay someone who is the third party, whom the theft is not, it's not compensating the one who has had the wrong done to them. For example, if a child steals, again, going back to the classroom, maybe one child steals a ruler from another child and in the process breaks the ruler. What often happens is the teacher will say, okay, you don't have any recess today, or you have to come in and help clean up the craft area or something like that. That's the punishment that's given. What happens is the poor child whose ruler is gone has no compensation. That's just a general principle. I give that example in a small way because it applies to a larger area as well. The problem with that penalty, of course, is that it brings about no justice, because justice involves restitution to the one who's harmed. And that's the first principle. Now you move into the second verse here, and it introduces a whole different topic altogether. In fact, he kind of goes one to another, but they build on one another as we go along. The second topic here is self-defense. A lot of us have interest in this topic right now. It describes a situation where a thief is caught in the act of breaking and entering into a home. And this is driven home by the literal translation of breaking in. That's how we translate it in English, but what it really is the idea of digging through. This person has dug through into the home. And that's the way it's going to be because in Israel, of course, they build their homes, at least their temporary homes like this, are made out of mud bricks. And so if someone's going to get into the home, not through the front door, they're going to dig through the side of the home somewhere in the mud, the dried mud, and get through there that way. But the idea is that if this individual who's digging through is caught in the act and someone strikes them, what happens in that situation? What happens if the person dies? If a result of his injuries from being struck, he's put to death? Well, the passage here says that no guilt applies to the homeowner for doing that. At least this is the case if the break-in occurs at night. But there is a differentiation between night and day here. And if this happens during the daytime, there's a different sort of restriction. He's not to kill the person, or he is held accountable for his killing the person if it happens during the daytime. Now remember that earlier in chapter 21, just the previous chapter, verse 12, we were told that striking a man in such a way that it results in his death, that's a capital offense. You're not to strike a man and put him to death. But here's a different circumstance when he's breaking into your home. His life must also be taken if he's the one who puts a person to death by striking him. But here, in the case of forced entry into a person's home, there's no guilt if it happens at night. But there is guilt if it happens during the day. Now, why the differentiation there, and why? What's the situation? Well, the difference lies in the fact that at night, it's impossible to tell whether the person who's breaking in has a weapon. You can't see well enough to know whether the person has a weapon that might be a threatening weapon that might cause harm to your family. The law protected the homeowner's right to assume the worst and to protect himself, his family, and his property under those circumstances. That's an important principle. And yet at the same time, the law upheld a high view of the person's life. Very important to remember that God values human life, whether it's a criminal or anybody else's life. Even that of the one breaking and entering, this person's life has value because he's created in the image of God. And so the law did not allow the homeowner to outright kill him if he could see during the daytime that he had no life-threatening instrument or weapon. Again, if the person lived, restitution is to be made, as well as paying a penalty as the judge saw fit. If he can't pay, then you have to go into an indentured servitude, kind of slavery. That's the word that's been translated here again and again. But even then, the six-year limit would apply because there's value in being free. And so there's restitution to be made, but the principle of upholding life is still there. God's interested in justice. He is a God of justice. He will see justice done, but he's also interested in the heart of the individual. Strangely enough, this criminal, it's not as though God simply says, it doesn't matter what you think about the criminal, because God in his law reflects this again. Verse 4, look at carefully at verse 4. It may seem at first to just be another example of restitution being made. You know, but when you compare it with that passage we read in Leviticus chapter 6, I hope you realize that there's a difference between those two passages. One says you have to pay double, or one says you have to pay, if it's one ox, you pay four more oxen to make it five. If it's one sheep, then you have to pay back three more to make it four sheep. But in that passage in Leviticus, we had only an adding of a fifth. Then why the difference? That's an interesting lesson. There in Leviticus, we're told that should a person voluntarily confess to his offense, that he would not have to pay the normal restitution, okay, sheep for sheep or item for item plus the additional amount, but here he needs only add one-fifth. That's leniency because the man or the guilty party has confessed openly. We would have only to add one-fifth the value of the thing stolen as penalty. Now, in other words, don't confess and you pay double or you pay triple or whatever it may be. But if you confess, then you need only add an additional one-fifth. Now, what's the point here? God is giving some room. He's actually encouraging, giving incentive in his law for people to openly admit guilt, to motivation to admit guilt and to confess your sins one to another. He shows leniency upon those who admitted their wrongdoing. Should a person own up to their sin and even make it right, then there's no need even necessarily to go to court. And what's more, God reveals that his people must be circumspect in regarding all of their actions, not just those that are intentional. It's not only the intentional taking of someone's property that we must avoid, but we must be careful that in our actions with our neighbors, and again, this is the second table of the law, which God's guiding us for how we deal with our neighbor one-to-one, then we must be careful that our neighbor not somehow be accidentally harmed in any way. God requires compensation for negligence here. Compensation for negligence. The example is given of a farmer who fails to take care that his livestock are cared for and kept in their pens. Some of the livestock somehow begin to wander, and they wander into someone else's field and begin to eat their crops and their grain and their and so forth. But we could easily insert here a couple other ways or other examples. Maybe a person in our day does not put up a fence around their swimming pool, and by that negligence, someone else might be harmed. Or maybe we fail to pay our car liability insurance. The same principle is there, you see. The point is that God's people must be extremely cautious that our personal choices do not impact others in a harmful way. We must be circumspect and intentional to avoid the situation in which my failing to do something, for example, might result in the other party being harmed. It's a direct application, I think, of Jesus' summary of the second table of the law when he said, you love your neighbor as you love yourself. That's the kind of response we are to have as we think about our neighbors. Do you fix your brakes on your car? Why do you do that? Well, you don't want to have an accident. You don't want to kill yourself. You don't want to be in danger. Well, then be sure that you do not drive, for example, after you've been drinking or drive recklessly or too fast or whatever it is, because you might put someone else in danger. You know, I was pretty careless one time over in Bloomington. I was burning leaves in my backyard, and I was all concerned that my house would be burned down if I didn't put out the fire. And I was a little careless, but I was not careful enough, because I thought to myself, well, it's a long distance away from my house. And just over the hill was my neighbor's new apartment complex. And the fire, I kind of did my best to put it out, but the wind was blowing, and I went inside and came back, and sure enough, the fire had begun to burn right down the hill, right to the neighbors. It was right at the base of his cement wall of his apartment complex. And I thought to myself, I was negligent. You see, I would be held accountable before God. I would be held in the law, or should have been held the law, if that had gone any farther. So we need to be careful to put out our fires. In other words, we need to be careful to watch for our neighbor's well-being as well as our own. And the summary is, be mindful of your neighbor's well-being just as you would yourself. That's the positive aspect of this law. Remember that the Ten Commandments have a positive as well as a negative aspect. So you have the law not to steal from your neighbor. What's the positive one? Be careful for your neighbor. Be careful not to do anything that would cause them harm. Don't fail to take precautions that safeguard your appreciation of the value of other people just as you value yourself. And of course, that's a principle we need to teach our children. The valuing of other people and their things, their property. That's a lesson that the Scriptures would have us teach. Philippians puts it this way, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others more important than yourself." General rule, great principle for us to put into practice. Need to be considerate. Take responsibility for the indirect consequences of your actions. And you'll notice that this is reinforced by the fact that the penalty for negligence, see here, is to go to your property, take the very best that you have, and you have to give that to your neighbor. You see, that's the idea. You're honoring them as more important than yourself. The best of your fields and vineyards, verse 5. Then what about these cases in where you have property and so on, but there's a question of dispute over who owns it for sure, or who's responsible for it during a particular time? If you lend your car to me, and while it's sitting in my driveway, someone steals it, you see, and that person gets away with it. They disappear, and I can't catch them. Who's responsible to compensate the owner of that car? The question then becomes, was there any negligence on my part? Was there something that I didn't do to take care of that car? Have I secretly maybe just hidden the car so that it looks like it was stolen, and I'm actually keeping the car? The question of law always comes in, what's going on here? So the law simply calls for there to be an investigation to thoroughly find out, discover the facts so that the judge can find out what's to be done. But how do you do that? One of the things that these laws begin to build upon one another. God is giving us a whole structure of law. And if I don't tell the truth, then we can't find justice here. Truth is very important. Justice requires truth, and thus an upholding of the ninth commandment. Don't bear false testimony. You have to hold these things all together. There's an assumption in these laws that there is a covenant obligational relationship within the family of God, among the people of God. Obviously, claiming to own something that was only lent to you, that's a breach of the trust of this covenant obligation that you might have. And again, the penalty for that violation is to pay double back to your neighbor. Making a false accusation against your neighbor in such a case was also heavily penalized. It's a breaking of the ninth commandment. The truth is the tool of justice. So breaking the ninth commandment is heavily penalized. So it is that the taking of an oath, as seen in verses 10 and 11, there's a way to settle the matter is this taking of an oath. It's the highest and most solemn form of declaring that you were innocent, that you didn't do something that was a crime. An oath taken in the name of the Lord. And again, what are we doing here but bringing in the third commandment? What is the third commandment? Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain. In other words, don't promise in the name of the Lord something that's false. That's taking the name of the Lord in vain. So we're adding the ninth commandment. Now we have the third commandment. We're dealing with the commandment about stealing, and all these others are beginning to build upon one another. And what happens when a person promises in this way, particularly if he's a covenant person with you in the family of God? You believe the promise. You believe the oath because it's taken in the name of the Lord. Well, to summarize this section, if I can, on private property, I would say this. We could say that a person's personal property is to be respected. Should someone be caught stealing it, it was necessary to require restitution and then a penalty on top of that added to dissuade any repeat of the action. A person was permitted to defend his property, but he had to respect the value of human life and weigh that against the value of the property itself, the material things versus a human life. We have to weigh that carefully. Then the law itself encouraged a person who was guilty of any of these sins. It's easy to think about someone sinning against you in these areas. But when we sin against others, how do we deal with that? If we're confessing our sin and settling the matter, trying to deal with this out of court, as it were, that's actually a reflection of how God has told us to deal with him in light of what's coming, the great judgment day. Settle the matter before you get to court. That's in Luke chapter 12, verses 58 and 59. As you go with your accuser before the magistrate, make an effort to settle with him on the way, lest he drag you in to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and the officer puts you in prison. I tell you, you'll never get out until you've paid the last penny. So the idea here is this: settling the matter. Go to your brother and make it right. Believers are to be careful to consider not only their own interests, but even go so far as to take care not to harm their neighbors, even by accident, by negligence. They must tell the truth. They must trust others who speak it as well. Let me move into the second area, this general area of laws of social responsibility. God begins with a common and yet a very serious offense by which one person can harm another. And it too is a form of robbery. In this case, it's the robbery of one's virtue or one's innocence. The issue here that's brought up is one of seduction. And we're touching now on another commandment, aren't we? We're touching on the seventh commandment and the implications of the seventh commandment: you shall not commit adultery. The principle here is that God has created man and woman as sexual creatures, but he has put boundaries so that they might experience the best of that sexuality within the context of the covenant bonds of marriage. Sexual intercourse was to be between a husband and a wife, and that is it. A husband and a wife, and that's the area for sexuality to be expressed in this way. Should a man convince a woman, for example, to engage in some sexual activity outside of the bonds of that covenant marriage, God actually required that those bonds be enforced anyway, particularly in the area of your wallet, where it really hurt, okay? He would have to pay the family the bridal cost as if he were getting married to her anyway. And then God actually required that he did have to marry her anyway. There was one exception, and that is if the father says, "I won't have that man be married to my daughter. I will not have it." In that case, that was permitted to say no, but if that happened, then he had to compensate. He had to pay. He had to give the penalty, additional compensation as well. So in this way, what happens is, in a sense, sexual behavior that's outside of the context of marriage is not allowed to exist outside of marriage. As soon as you try to do so outside of marriage, you're put in the context of marriage by the law. People were held accountable to keep God's ways, even when it might be considered in our day, I'm sure we would consider it this way, or many would, this is a private matter. What are you doing getting in my private life? No, this is not your private life alone. People are held accountable before God. And one of the reasons our society, I would suggest, is in moral freefall when it comes to sexuality is that we have erased all penalty. And have actually now not just erased the penalty, but we now begin to propagate the exact opposite idea of what the law is intended to do here. We now propagate the idea that promiscuity is normal, that it's natural. It's not, friends. This is what God is revealing. It is not. Promiscuity of that nature is sinful, and God would have us follow his ways that we might experience the best. What a shame it is that young men and young women, not just young men and young women, older men and older women are involved in things which are taking away the best. You might think that the next case that's raised here doesn't fit under the heading of social responsibility, really, but God places it here nonetheless. He begins now with a category of offenses that are actually very serious, to the point of being a capital offense. In verse 18, we begin with the first of three offenses that God says warrants the death penalty. And the first practice is the being involved in sorcery, or the occult, I would say. And the word used here is a feminine noun. It says, don't let a sorceress, that's a feminine noun, but the feminine noun actually refers to a category of things which are sorcery in general, so that a man or a woman could be involved in this and still be guilty. Do not allow anyone to be involved in sorcery is the idea. And the first practice here is this area of one seeking. What is sorcery other than trying to find power or influence by means of something other than what God has intended, through magic, and what is this other than purely seeking demonic powers or satanic power, getting that source being someone other than God? Of course, it makes sense that God's people would be utterly forbidden for them. Why would they seek power and strength from any other source than the God who has all power, who has made himself available to them? Seek me, he says, and I will give you what it is you need. Psalm 68, 35 makes it very clear. We sing Psalm 68 very good. I've always enjoyed this. John Edgar used to sing this psalm. He was a precentor in my congregation, and when we get to the end, he would say, he would actually lead the song this way. Nobody would ever follow him, but you appreciate this. That he would be leading the psalm, and he would get to the point where strength and power, and he would hold that word power, and some people would stumble a little bit as they find, oh, he's not going on. And then he would finish the last phrase. But the idea is that the Lord himself is the one who is our source. He gives his people strength and power. Why is it that they would seek anything else? Now, the pagan world wrestled with the issue of what do you do when people are seeking demonic power? How do you deal with that? Pagan world said it's okay for you to do this as long as what you're doing, that you don't try to curse anyone else. You don't try to harm anyone else in what you're doing. So even the wicked thing that you're doing is okay as long as you don't harm anyone else. Does that sound familiar to you in our day? That is a mantra of today's world, right? You may do whatever you want to do as long as it doesn't harm someone else. That's the word of the day. But God has never allowed that sort of nonsensical ideology in any way, because it leaves him out of the picture, right? God says, what about my law? What about my ways? And what's more, God is not just concerned with his own justice. He's kind and compassionate for his creation. And he says, why would I let you harm yourself in this way? Why would I let you be taken over by the enemy and be controlled by the enemy in that way? Why would I let you play with evil? And so he puts down the harshest of penalties. Again, what's the purpose of putting someone to death? It's to dissuade others that there be no kind of activity like this, so that they would see this is the consequence of participating in evil like that. And then we move to an even uglier situation, or maybe it's similarly ugly, I guess. The second crime that receives the death penalty here is bestiality. It's a perversion of human sexuality that goes beyond even sexual interaction or behavior outside of marriage between two humans. In the pagan world, particularly in the area of Canaan, they, of course, worshipped many gods, goddesses of all kinds. And often those gods and goddesses were put in the form, man making an image of something in his after his likeness, in a sense, but he makes it in the image of an animal. So these animals, all kinds of gods and goddesses in Canaan, particularly, that were animalistic. And so man, in his distortion of things, in his suppressing of the truth, his turning from the real God, he seeks blessing and fertility from these false gods, and even going so far as to have interaction sexually with an animal as a way of making that part of a cultic activity, seeking God's blessing, you see, this God's blessing. Well, that was so ugly back then, we think, that doesn't happen today. But it does. It really does. And let me just maybe draw something from this that I think is very important. Strangely enough, this case study is extremely relevant to our day. For what made this activity of a capital offense in God's eyes? Why was this worthy of death? Was the fact that it was, in the words of John McKay, a flagrant disregard of the structure and the order that God had endowed in creation. God gave man and woman in the garden structure and order for all of life, and that pertained to their sexuality as well. That order was for one man and one woman within the covenant bonds of marriage to have a beautiful relationship of sexuality together. Romans 1 speaks about a similar disregard for God's structure and his order that he has given. Verse 22, listen how carefully this is put. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their heart to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. Why are things so bad in our world sexually? It's because people have exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Now, I think largely Romans 1 is speaking about homosexuality there, when it talks about them giving up of their bodies to one another. That's what's largely being described. But it flows out of exactly the same thing that we're talking about here in Exodus 22, of disregarding God and exchanging His good design, His order, for a distortion, for a perversion of that, none of which can begin to compare in beauty and delight to what God has designed. They have exchanged the glory of God's good for a satanic perversion. Friends, that's what homosexuality is. It's a perversion of God's good order. Laws used to protect God's design and order, didn't they? Largely, we attempted to do so in our laws. But having exchanged God's interests for man's interests, man then is left in our day to pursue his lusts that lead him down a destructive and an empty path. That's the second of the three offenses. The final one is behind both the other two. And that is a direct violation of the first commandment. That is worship of another god other than the true God. False worship. Verse 20, whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. Do you find it harsh in our day where we all say anyone can believe whatever they want as long as it doesn't harm someone else? That God would require almost here the death penalty, in a sense, for worshiping a false god, worshiping anything other than him? I want to remind you that it still carries with it a death penalty today. Not on this earth, perhaps, but certainly an eternal penalty. God's laws always point to the reality that he is the way, he is the truth, and he is the life that there is to have. And there is no other. Let's move on. I got to move on. We're time-wise. The final verses speak about our treatment of the disadvantaged. And again, just for time's sake, we'll mention them here all together. How do we deal with those who are outsiders, foreigners? How do we deal with widows? How do we deal with those who are orphans, fatherless? How do we deal with those who are poor, disadvantaged? And in summary, I think we see reflected in these laws the principle of doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. There are always in society those who are at disadvantage, and our call here is to simply treat them carefully, not to take advantage of them. And I think it's even more serious than that, because God himself is said to pay special heed to their cry. Someone who is disadvantaged, someone who is an alien, someone who is an orphan, when they cry out to God, God's saying, I listen to that cry because I'm a compassionate God. And he pledges to intervene on behalf of the disadvantaged, like a father who says, if you mess with my child, you're going to deal with me. I could almost do that more dramatically, couldn't I? If you mess with my child, I'm going to take you out. Listen to what he says. If you do with my child harshly, no, he actually says this in verse 23. If you do mistreat them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry and my wrath will burn and I will kill you with the sword and your wives shall become widows and your children will become orphans. I mean, wow, this is coming from our loving, gentle Savior. Friends, this is who our God really is. He's all of those things, gentle and loving and kind and compassionate. He's just announced himself as a compassionate God. But he loves those who are in need. And if they cry out to him, he rises up. In the spirit of God's laws, friends, as we seek to apply the principles so that we have the character of God in us, it implies that we must not only avoid mistreating these who are of this kind of situation, but we must become their advocates. We must have the same heart that we rise up and defend those who are weak and disadvantaged. It's a great challenge to us in our affluence, isn't it? It really is a challenge to us because we're so comfortable in our affluence. We see other people who are in the disadvantaged situation and we say, now, why did you get there? I wonder all the bad things that you've done to get yourself there. And that's part of it, so no doubt. But nevertheless, God's attitude toward them is the same. And it's particularly the calling of the church to rise up in this way. Well, perhaps we can sum up the final verses by simply saying that God would have his people be a holy people, a consecrated people. We are to give to God what is God's. That's an honoring of him for who he is. Hallowed be thy name. Our lives are consecrated to him. These laws call us to love him with all of our heart, all of our soul, all of our strength, all of our mind, and then our neighbors as ourselves. We fall so far short. That's the purpose of this law, is to show you that, so that we might turn to him. He lifts us up from the ash heap. How does he do so? You know, we sing that the Lord lifts us from the ash heap and sets us upon a rock. How does he do it? By providing the atonement of his son Jesus. May we commit to walking in his ways because of what he's done for us in Jesus. He talks about them being careful not to treat the sojourner this way because you were a sojourner. Friends, you were weak. You were disadvantaged. You were helpless. And the Lord Jesus Christ came and rescued. Let's treat others that way as well. May God help us. Let's pray. Father in heaven, your laws are intricate. And in them we see your love and your compassion and even your purposes for your people. That they would experience good. That they would know peace and security. That they would have justice. Help us, Father, in these intricate ways to learn how to apply them to ourselves in our day and our situations. We live in a fallen world, Father, but we're also fallen people. I thank you that we are a redeemed people. And I pray that you would then help us to live as such, to live a testimony before the world, that as we carry out that same commission to go into all the world and make disciples of the nations, that you would enable us to live in a way that our testimony, our lives, are actually consistent with the message we're saying. Help us then this for the glory of your son Jesus, that he might be lifted up more and more. In Jesus we pray. Amen.